divide and conquer tactics of the rich. It's the oldest trick in the book. They want to blame the frustrations of working class people. They want to take those frustrations. They want to blame it on race. They want to blame it on LGBTQ plus people. They want to blame it on some destitute and desperate person at the border. They do that because they want working class people to be divided and to focus and keep the focus off the one true enemy, corporate greed. The rich think we're stupid. But working class Americans see this for what it is. This is our generation's defining moment. So I have a question for you. Are you ready to stand up, speak up, and show up and put Kamala Harris and Tim Walz in the White House? We need a defender of the working class in the White House. Someone who is one of us and someone who knows how to fight. And that fighter is the next president of the United States, Kamala Harris. Thank you.
That was Sean Fain, president of the United Auto Workers, speaking at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August. And that does it for this Labor Day special. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharifa Dokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamariu Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
This morning, we will not be broadcasting more talk radio with Cecil Prescott. He will be back next week. Please enjoy the next show on the schedule. And thank you for listening to KBOO Portland.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
DVD Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. The last couple of weeks, we've been talking about the fallout around the Olympics, the conversations around breaking, and they've been layered, and there's a lot of levels to those conversations. One of the overarching themes involves culture, and we heard words, buzzwords, cultural appropriation, who has a right to dance, who doesn't, what does it mean when it shows up on the largest stage, who created it, who the guest to the culture, all these types of buzzwords have been popping up left and right. And I wanted to bring two people, actually three, to the table that are knee deep and versed in these aspects. One of them is a pioneering dancer. He's a scholar in his own right, teaches at NYU. Somebody who is also a good friend, no stranger to our airwaves. And we're glad to see that you are recovering, you know, on the way to recovering. Popmaster Fable, his name is known around the world for his work and his scholarship. Many people have built off his words and have built off his moves. And, you know, he suffered a car accident. Somebody hit him and did a hit and run and left him badly injured. And he's been on the road to recovering, still has his faculties, and we're glad to have you with us. And definitely able to weigh in on this conversation. He has an article that is in the Amsterdam News in New York that leaves us with a lot to think about. The other person is a scholar as well. He's written a couple of books. He's part of the Oakland Maroons, and he's no stranger when it comes to these type of topics. You know, he's my go-to guy for a lot of these things. His name is Quadro Dedeville, and hopefully we should be joined by Dr. Donna Lisa Fisher, who's an anthropologist, among other things, and also knee-deep in hip-hop. And I didn't realize, had a lot to say about the judging and all these other things. She was involved in those circles, and hopefully she can share her insights as well.
Wow.
I want to start off with the obvious question. We hear the word culture. And I want to know what that really means for you guys. And when I ask this question, I'm looking in the backdrop of somebody, literally seeing somebody wearing gold teeth, walking around with gold teeth. It's a man, that's culture vulturing. Huh? Wearing gold teeth, is that, whose culture is that? You know, somebody's like, you're drinking a 40 ounce and smoking a blunt. That's what we do. Don't steal from us. And then there's the other thing of having a way in which you carry yourself, the history that you have, things that you wear that have significance. You know, maybe it's a kimono, you know, maybe it's a gi, maybe it's a dashiki shirt or a hairstyle. And folks may say, well, that's culture. And so there's a lot of that being bantered around when you see somebody dance. Is it culture? Whose culture? You know, is one type of dance indigenous to a particular population versus something that has been in the forefront and on, you know, popular culture? So I want to start off with just getting an understanding of how do we define culture, especially as it pertains to a people. And I'll start off with you, Quadro.
Wow, that's a huge question. Hope I can do it justice here. Culture is basically the personality of a people. And so these things are constituted by, you know, location, context, historical context, and things of that nature. And so language, I guess, plays a very large part. And when I say language, I'm talking about language, not just in the sense that we normally think of it, and when someone is having discourse or talking to someone or writing. Language also shows up in bodily movement. So language shows up in the unspoken in many different ways. And so I'm hoping that as we talk about this particular topic, we start talking about those things that have been, especially because we're talking about Africans born in America and the culture of Africans born in America, that we begin to talk about those things that were specifically designed culturally to prevent being audited by the status quo, the white status quo that was ontologically dangerous to us. And those cultural methods and ways of being are the things that have basically saved us from destruction here in the diaspora. Black folks from destruction here in the diaspora. You know, one of the common ones that is spoken of mostly is the notion of the code switch, right? And so my contention, my point here is that the code switch shows up in many different things in many different ways that we.
When you say code switch, when you say code switch, what does that mean?
The code switch basically is a way of communicating without being audited by the white status quo. What it means is being able to communicate with the status quo in one voice and manner of speaking, even in terms of the given art form that we're talking about. And then there's an inner circle, culturally intimate way that African people deal with each other that is not audited by the status quo. It is a different thing. I'll give different examples.
Right. What comes to mind as you were talking was thinking of Capoeira and what purpose that served. You know, because on one hand somebody looking at it said, oh, those nice people are just dancing in a circle. It's like, no, we're training to fight. The other thing might be coming to mind is the drum. You know, and what that meant. All those nice savages are playing drums. Mm-hmm. And within the circle, no, those drums are a form of communication and, you know, enhancement of spirituality. So is that what you mean, being subversive?
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of cut to the chase when you said capoeira. I was a practitioner and teacher of capoeira for 17 years, mostly in the Bay Area. And, you know, capoeira itself is a combination of things that includes a martial art, but there are all types of other things that happen within this visual event, this ritual that is happening in a circle that we call the Horda. And for the most part, those outside of the circle looking in that aren't participants in it are not auditing it in the ways that people who are within, literally within the circle, within the Horda are auditing it. There's a language that happens there, and there's a way of delivering attack and defense so that it does not look as if it is attack and defense. And of course, right. The legendary, both history/myth surrounding capoeira is that it was supposed to be entertainment. And so it was using the white status quo's condescension towards the intellectual capacities of Africans, enslaved Africans, that prevented them from seeing the fact that this is not just an entertainment and a pastime to amuse them, that it was actually something that was strengthening many different things, the gamesmanship, the rituals that were passed along from various African religions, et cetera, and so forth, in the cosmology of the Horda itself. There's just many, many different things contained within the context of it.
Appreciate that, Quadrel Dedeville. Let me bring in Popmaster Fable. How do you see culture?
I appreciate what was shared thus far in regards to defining culture. I don't necessarily have a scholarly, per se, right, breakdown of what that word is, or even on a high collegiate level or what have you. In layman's terms, and just like as a cat who grew up in the hood and actually still live in the hood, sort of, I can speak on the word culture based just on firsthand on what it means to me and not necessarily what's in the textbook.
Right.
So being that I'm Boricua, so-called Puerto Rican descent. Obviously, we grew up with Afro-Caribbean roots. So, and I'll be using another slave language, which is Spanish, to define some of the stuff I'm saying.
Okay.
Both English slave language and Spanish slave language, and Spanglish, if you will. So, nuestra cultura, our culture is a wonderful blend of so many different things, being that we also those of us who are conscious embrace our African roots, and we embrace our indigenous roots and what have you. So for us, for instance, cultura or culture, for many of us, is basically your way of life. It's how you move and groove through life, and how you express yourself, and how you stand in your square and you solidify your purpose as not just an individual, but as a community and as a people. So quite often there's artistic expression, which is the obvious in a so-called culture. Different ways that we express ourselves. Some of it was already mentioned. People might say the drums, oh, that guy plays good. We call it un tambor, right? Plays a good tambor. Meanwhile, they have no idea that we're communicating to the next village that a baby was born, or that someone transitioned and became an ancestor. Right. So there's all of that stuff, which then seeps into the spiritual aspects of things. So it's not just on face value. There's a much, much, much deeper connection to the spirit in terms of when I think of culture. And so quite often when I'm talking about breaking or rocking or b-boying, b-girling, etc., or our hip-hop culture in general, quite often I use the word our sacred culture. Because for me, it transcends just going through the motions of being artistically inclined and what have you. This is all sort of forms of worship and ways of letting your soul soar, letting your soul soar. So I can go on and on, but in a nutshell, that's what culture is for me.
I mentioned at the start that you're quoted, and then you, I think, went into a little bit more depth on your Facebook post, the article in the Amsterdam News, where they have a few quotes from you. And what I've always known you to be is very consistent in making that spiritual connection. I think one of the advices that you gave to people is to know the history. You know, you said, look at these indigenous roots, look at these African roots. And I think you gave some very specific aspects to look into. I bring that up because oftentimes people say culture, but then they don't want to connect themselves to a history. And I don't know if that is something that is a requirement when you talk about culture, or is it just like, nah, this is just how I do. And, you know, my history may be 10 minutes old and that's how it is. But it seems like what I'm hearing from both of you is that there's some roots to whatever it is that you do. And really, to understand culture, we got to know those roots, even if you don't necessarily see them, you know. And I'll just use the tree that's in front of my house. If you see this tree, and you can see this tree all the way from the freeway, right? It's a huge tree, stands about, you know, a couple of hundred feet, right? And you don't see the roots, but you will see this tree. You'll see hawks in the tree, all these other things. And even when you see the roots, you can't see the roots because it's on a hill, and the way the roots go, you know, it's literally under the house. But if you don't understand its roots, like if you just come and hit that tree a certain way, you know, you might be messed up because you don't realize that you're actually standing on its roots, if that's making sense. You know, like you just can't knock the tree down. You got to really dig into the foundation of my house to get everything out, or to even understand why it's even able to stand the way that it does, you know, if that's making sense. So can we build on that? Is this making sense about understanding these roots? Which I think also, to Fable's point, connects to spirit at the end of the day as well.
I think it's a good metaphor. The thing that came to mind when you were talking was that, you know, someone could come there, be sitting, you know, on top of grounds where those roots are very deep, and not even know it. You know, they may just be taking for granted the space around them, And basically the space has been constituted by those roots and the shade in that tree and the life that's been happening in that tree. And they just come there and, you know, they may be trespassing and not know it,
right,
so to speak, you know what I mean? Or they may damage something, you know, by doing something on those grounds, and it damages those roots or damages the tree just because they take advantage of it and of the resources given by the tree, but aren't really knowing what the tree requires for its life and things of that nature. So
keyword, yeah, taking resources from the tree is a very key aspect, because yeah, that seems to often happen with culture.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That happens with culture, you know, and the danger with that is that, you know, you can alter the, you know, the environment of the culture in a way that does it harm. And in the way that it's perceived, in the way that it's, you know, forward facing to the world. If we're talking, you know, specifically about things like capoeira, jazz, hip hop, those would be my main, you know, talking points for today. Those three things. And so that oftentimes, you know, happens. And people, there's a certain degree of entitlement wherein one can come to an environment and not ask questions. Or believe that the environment is there for you just because you arrived. I'll land my plane there. Let my brother here say his piece.
You want to add to that fable?
Hmm. Well, I agree, obviously, 1,000% that. It's, you know, if you really want to understand our cultures and our people, right, be it Mama Africa, the diaspora, be it indigenous folks, aborigines, or what have you, you have to swim in deep waters. You can't just touch on the surface. So that analogy you used about the tree, the roots run deep. What runs even deeper are the nutrients that feed the roots and the environment that it grows on, the fertile environment. So, you know, the topic is cultural appropriation, right? And yeah. So, you know, I'm... by the grace and mercy of God Almighty, I survived the hit and run. And inshallah, April 22nd, I'll reach the big 6-0.
Wow. Okay.
So I'm not necessarily first generation hip hop. That's Herc, Bam, those guys, you know? Many names that are never mentioned, like, you know, like Smokey from Smokey and the Smokatrons, and there's many names that aren't necessarily hollered as often as the obvious ones, you know?
Right.
So my point simply is that although I'm not first generation, I'm old enough to have grown up in that environment. You know, when New York was New York, like, when it had serious dirt under its fingernails,
right,
the grime, you know what I'm talking
when
about.
When 42nd was the deuce,
right?
And when it wasn't Disney, and it was in Disneyland, and you didn't go down there unless you had business to deal with.
Right, you had no business over there.
You had no business over there as a kid,
right?
Yes.
Unless you were handling something, or you were with a crew, or you were strapped.
Yeah,
those are facts, dude. Right. So anyway, I love the analogy of the tree and the roots and how people really have no idea, some people that is, you know, what grounds they're standing on or what fruit they're picking and trying to eat, and everything that went into that fruit, including the environment, the oxygen, the nutrients, the soil, the earth, the pain, the suffering, the blood, the sweat, the tears. I can go on and on. So when I, just to cut to the chase, I hope I'm not I'm not going too far in advance. This is your moderating this. Yeah. I'm not trying to feel you feel me. Like I want to.
We're people, so
I want to follow your lead.
Yeah,
I want to follow your lead, but I'm itching already, bro. You heard?
So bring the funk, as they say.
I got you, brother. Right on. So, cultural appropriation and you know, b-boying / b-girling in the Olympics, breaking, rocking. There's so many names for it, you know. Without once again giving too much attention to this one individual that totally should not have been on that platform.
Right.
And I just want to preface everything by saying this. I don't support our sacred dance in the Olympics. I don't. I don't believe it's a sport. I don't believe it's a dance sport, as they're trying to label it. None of that. It's a form of cultural expression. You know, it's not a basketball game, you heard, or baseball or anything like that. You feel me? Is it highly competitive? Of course it is, because that's how brilliant we are as Black and Brown people. We're constantly pushing the envelope and challenging each other. You know, you whack. Nah, you whack. Well, battle me then. Let's see who's really whack. You feel me? And that's how all of our components excelled, from MCing, so-called rapping, to turntablers and the DJ and, you know, everything, the aerosol art, the fashion, who's the flyest guy, who's the flyest girl. Our whole thing was like, who's the most original, number one? I don't want to be like the next cat. I want to floss my own original swag and style, etc. So my point is, like, you know, to properly understand what this is, the intensity of our culture, if people really knew, they would never call it a sport.
Right.
They wouldn't. It's like, what if we right now went to the Diné tribe or the Mohicans and went, you know, or went to the Amazon and went into, went to a tribe or Mama Africa, anywhere where there are indigenous people actually living like they used to hundreds of years ago in harmony with nature. And you go and you say, hey, let me talk to you. Oh, wow, I really love that dance you guys are doing, right? What kind of a dance is that? Oh, well, we're doing this, because we are asking, spiritually, we're asking for rain for our crops to grow. Or we're about to engage in a war. So this is how we get ready, you know? We do, oh, okay, cool. So now I'm taking that and I'm putting it in the Olympics and I'm calling it a sport. How you figure, man? You know? How you figure that all of a sudden you're snatching some sacred stuff and stamping this label on it, and you think that's cool in the gang? So that's my point. Like, because hip-hop got so commercialized, it's basically up for grabs, or they think it is. They think they can pick it apart, take this, take that, run with it, monetize off of it, etc., and completely lose the real purpose of these components, which basically is to help you navigate through life. I've taught at NYU for 25 years. Do you think I was looking to make great dancers? No, I wasn't. I was like, if you happen to wind up learning some cool stuff and expressing yourself as a dancer, good for you. But my thing was giving them a toolbox and teaching them, you know, self-esteem and self-empowerment, balance, coordination, sense of pride, cultural realities, how to multitask, how to use your peripherals, how to study your space differently. How to be multi-directional, how to be multi-level. You know, dude, my hair is stand up only because that's the brilliance of our culture, man. Mm-hmm. This is mm-hmm. really what it's about.
Yes.
It's not about putting a, excuse my language, you know, a gold medal around your neck and pose it up like you're the. Nah, you know, they missed the whole point. They missed the whole point, man.
Pop Master Fable in the building. So, you know, I got to smirk a little bit at what you're saying because, you know, I talked to Quadro a little bit more than I talked to you. And, you know, last week we had a back and forth about this thing, whether or not it should have been in the Olympics. And, you know, and he had the same exact position as you did and then some. So I'm going to have to concede because I might be able to deal with one of y'all in a debate, but I ain't trying to deal with both. I'm not going to try and deal with both because...
Fair enough, brother. Fair enough.
Look at it. And you don't even know each other. Yeah, he's sitting back. And it's like, man, what did I just say? Literally, go ahead. You did tell me that, did you not? You did say it.
I did. It was a good conversation. I enjoyed it. And, you know, this is something that's come up before, you know, when I was as far back as the mid-1980s, when I first started training capoeira, because there was talk even around that time in regards to having capoeira, quote unquote, tournaments and, you know, and characterizing, you know, capoeira as the Brazilian national sport, you know, things of that nature. And so, you know, just like he said a moment ago, there's so much more to it, and that's the way it's supposed to be. And what I'm going to go over now is this point that I made in regards to the status quo, white status quo, basically trying to take these forms, and they'll do two things. One, they will create an origin myth that basically positions whatever the art form, the African diasporic art form, into a narrative that makes it part of the narrative myth of the nation state, the white settler colony that it was created in. You see, without taking into consideration the lineages and cultural amalgamations that happen amongst Black/African people that are created without taking to consideration of the long narratives of history that took place before them.
Let me stop you there for 1 second just to ask a question for clarity.
Sure.
Because when the discussion to make capoeira the Brazilian national sport, did they have the word resistance in there? And here's why I ask this.
It's counter to that. That's what I'm getting at.
Because just to kind of make it plain and then, you know, come back to your point. I don't want to cut you off, but I just want to kind of give some context. I was a part of the anti-apartheid movement at Cal, right? And I teach over at SF State, right? In a department that all came about because there was, you know, sharp opposition, right? And, you know, you go to Cal now and they'll be like the home of the free speech movement, the home of the apartheid movement, anti-apartheid movement, come here. And I'm like, man, I remember people getting knocked upside the head with the bully club, right? Mm-hmm. There were people that were adamantly against it, but now it's a marketing thing and it's part of the lore to come to this storied university, UC Berkeley, the home of the anti-apartheid movement, where they tore down the shanty towns and was whooping people up and down the campus, right?
I was
Same thing with SS State, you know, the third world department, you know, I mean, free you know, it's yeah, all those things. So when you were saying that immediately came to mind, you know, when you said they want to make it the national sport. So pick up from there.
Sure. In terms of capoeira in places like Rio de Janeiro and Salvador Bahia, especially Rio de Janeiro, this thing was outlawed. You know, you could be, you know, jailed, imprisoned. In some areas, they say that the main instrument, the birimbau, if you were found with this instrument, you could have your hand chopped off, basically. And so we go from that, you know, of it being something that was such a pariah, quote unquote, to the white settler state, because they understood at a certain point that this was an act of resistance. They're training their warrior spirits in order to resist captivity. moving into the 20th century, they tried to change it into something that would be formalized, where you can go to a classroom, you know, a class, and learn this and learn to think formally. And then you'll get certain types of belts, and the colors of the belts will be the tricolor of the nation state. You know, we got a white belt, a green belt, you know, and a yellow belt, you know, for capoeira. And so it's basically the colors of the Brazilian flag. And now it's, you know, characterized as you might go into an airport or something like that, or a tourist newsstand, and see something that says, you know, capoeira, the Brazilian national sport. Same thing happens with jazz. Jazz is constrained to what they say are, you know, houses of prostitution and things that are in the lower parts of the ghetto, basically where black people live, and the white status quo, the moneyed white status quo, comes to that area to be entertained by black people, and then they leave, and it's looked down upon. It's not compared to European Western classical music. Even though it is basically probably the most prominent and ingenious aesthetic of the 20th century that influenced all of the musics that came after it. But now there's been some narratives for many years now that says that jazz is, you know, America's classical music, that, you know, jazz is America's art form. And so they co-opt it, and then they also create these kind of also multiculturalist creation myths where, you know, everybody was involved. Well, hey, you know, there were Italians and Irish people there and everything, you know, in New Orleans doing this, and leave out things like Congo Square, the real efficacy and power of Congo Square that really created that that aesthetic. And so from my standpoint, this is the same thing that happened with the notion of bringing hip hop hip hop aesthetic vis-a-vis breakdancing to the world stage. What the intention of people that do this is to capture it in a way where it can be audited. In other words, put it in a definition that we can say these are the parameters of it. And if it doesn't have these parameters, then it is not authentic in our eyes. We will not pay for it in certain contexts. You see what I'm saying? And so with hip hop, what they've done is they've turned this into a type of competition that does not take into consideration those aspects of it that my brother here was talking about that are not auditable, not measurable by Western terms, you see? And those things are in there purposefully. That's what makes it an African diasporic expression. There are things in there that are not measurable by Western standards. And so what they do is they take that aesthetic in a way and put it in a museum or some sort of context wherein they can measure it with points, numbers, counting and measuring. Europeans love counting and measuring. And so the danger of this is that they also become the purveyors of what is authentic and what is not authentic. They passive aggressively become that. And so the outside world looking at this then also becomes to take on their value systems, Western value system of counting and measuring, to determine what is authentic and what is not authentic. That has happened in capoeira. That has happened in jazz music. That has happened in regards to breakdancing. One of the things that happened with jazz music is that there was a series of intellectuals like the Stanley Crouches, Albert Murrays, Wynton Marcellus, and Branford Marcelluses of the world that ended up at jazz at Lincoln Center. And they began to discuss jazz as this thing that happened between a certain period of time that includes these people that were doing more, mainstream, in quotation marks, I put that in quotation marks, type of music. Not the avant-garde, not the radical black nationalist avant-garde that happened in the 1960s with people like Archie Shepp and John Coltrane and, you know, Marion Brown and others, and some of the things that Miles Davis did from 1969 through to 1975. They would cut that part out of it, but they will take the things that Miles Davis did from, say, 1957 on up to 1968 and say, oh, no, he was doing jazz then, but it broke at this particular point. We don't want to look at this other stuff where he's doing these, you know, Pan-African things and naming tunes after freedom fighters in Pan-African freedom fighters in Africa. So that happened, you know, in the 1980s. And the reason why that happened is because, here again, what it does is it makes jazz into this museum piece that can be audited by people who have built up a certain language on the histories, and then they become the authorities. And it takes the other experts, intellectual experts, out of the picture. So you see, you know, the names of like a Greg Tate and an Amiri Baraka and folks like that, or even Ntozake Shange, who's a very brilliant jazz scholar, much less given much less authority than those conservatives like a Ralph Ellison, a Albert Murray, or a Leonard Feather,
right,
and people that Ken Burns, and you know, people of that nature.
Let me, I appreciate you going there. That's the voice of Quadrille Denneville talking about culture, cultural appropriation. We also have Pop Master Fable, second generation or third generation dancer out of hip hop and a scholar in his own right. Let me ask you this, Fable. Does culture have to be static? Is it room for it to grow, to evolve, and to grow new roots, so to speak, or take on a different direction? You know, if I use this tree that I'm talking about in my backyard, and if a building which is actually being constructed shows up and it shades the tree a particular way, it's going to move in another direction eventually. You know, the branches will seek, you know, another way to go to get the sunlight. And
right.
I think this goes back to reacting to the environment in which it is, and culture is fluid that way. So in a world where there is proverbial sunlight and being seen and being heard on the world stage, in a world where you do have people coming from all sorts of backgrounds participating, is culture allowed to move in that direction? Even if we say it's sacred, is that part of its journey, its sacredness? I mean, and I'll use one other example, our religion. We came up and we have certain types of aspects of religion that say, you know, cut off somebody's hand if they lie. We don't do that. It doesn't reflect the cultural dynamics in which we live. It may have made sense, 100 years ago, but it don't make sense now. And does culture have room to grow and accommodate the current, political, economic, and cultural landscape that we reside in?
Of course. Listen, nothing stays stagnant. Things change whether people like it or not. Things grow, things change, molecules vibrate, things morph into other things. We can't stop the body rock, what happens, happens. My thing is this, will we stand around silently and watch something that helped so many of us in so many other ways, will we stand silently and watch it be completely snatched out of its essence and element and placed in a sort of sterile spot where now someone else is where it's losing its essence and what have you? Like, look, even with all of my criticism of it being called a sport and it winding up in the Olympics, etc., I'm just one voice. I had a feeling the day will come that I'll sit down and I'll be like, all right, let's turn the TV on. Here we go. Mm-hmm. As much as I was against it. And that's precisely what happened. I sat there and I watched it. And I have to say, I hate to say I told you so, but yeah, I was like, all right, be careful what you ask for. Be careful what you ask for, because Once it's out of our hands, anything can happen. So I'm all for hip-hop, are the components of our sacred culture evolving, finding new ways to be expressed, new ways to benefit people's lives. For me, it's more about that. How is it helping you?
Right.
Is it, are you advancing? Are you evolving as a human being? Are you advancing as a human being? Is it bringing a sense of purpose? Is it helping bring a sense of purpose to your life? Besides winning a battle.
Right.
I mean, real steel, like, you know, what is it? What are we really doing here with these gifts, with these precious gifts that we were given? So along those lines, if it finds its way in different platforms and different spaces and different dimensions, if everything I just mentioned, those questions are part of the equation, let's rock. I'll support it. I'll throw my fist up in the air and be like, yo, let's go, man, you know? As right. long as it's, again, for the people.
Let me complicate this a little now, because we talked about culture evolving. So one of the ways that we have culture evolving is to look and say, Quadro, Fable, this dance that you're doing, this practice, this expression, this is our expression. It ain't yours. Fable, you have a Bariquan background. You're a guest. Quadro, you're from California. You're a guest. You know, you Jamaican guy, you're a guest. This is our thing, right? And we have a lot of that going on, to the point that you may have been here from damn near day one, but I'm going to sit there and be 30 years your junior and tell you that, you know, you stole my stuff. You know, even though I never attempted to look at this history, I attempted to practice this expression, none of that. And so the backdrop that we live in now has done exactly what some of the corporations have done. They put things in boxes, they give it a definition, it's a rigid one, and it's something that is almost arbitrarily, you know, what percentage of Black are you? Are you mixed? Or are you really, really Black? You know, do you have, you know, you have some Canadian in you? Then you're not like us, you know? Puerto Rican, you ain't Black, right? You literally have people saying that 50 years after an inception, when that was never a conversation. And I'll get some other context. There were rigorous and heated and I think in-depth discussions, whether with Meeting of the Minds or gatherings with Zulus and the whole nine, where people were like, let's go through some of this stuff. And people came to conclusions and was like, you know, we all are here. But now it's a very different terrain. And I would argue, in conclusion, some of that has been artificially inserted by yes. outside pressures that have come Absolutely. In and said, you know, you are not the same. You know, you didn't go through the same hardships, even though the island that we call Puerto Rico was the first stop on the slave ship. You know, or one of the first. So let's make this, because this is where you start to get, you know, folks who will sit back and go, you culturally appropriated these sacred things. When, you know, I'm like, have you even practiced any of these sacred expressions outside of the way it's presented in a commercial and a corporate setting? You know, have you actually right. gone to where these things are born, or is it just your birthright? Like, you get to just claim it. Out of, you know, because, you know, like, I just inherited. I'm from the yeah. Bronx, so I'm hip-hop automatically. Even though I might have been a person who lived in the Bronx who tried to shut it down and who demeaned it, the same way that the university didn't want the anti-apartheid struggles, but now it's a part of it and gets to define. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'll start with you.
I'm so glad that you brought up this, because what you're talking about basically is, who has the authority to construct the historical narrative of what gave birth to the culture, who has the authority to say what is authentic and what is not authentic, who has the authority to say what will be visible and what will not be visible, those types of things. And I find suspicious any group that that basically does the job of divide and rule for the status quo, for a capitalist white status quo hegemony that is always trying to control these cultural art forms, because they're born in resistance. They are born in a type of ontological resistance. When I say ontological resistance, what I mean by that is just ways of being. In other words, each of these art forms that we're talking about is a way of someone who is being caged into a certain space of saying, I have freedom and mastery of my space. A capoeirista has mastery of their space. Someone like my brother here has a mastery of breakdancing and pop lock, and he is mastering the space in ways that the status quo cannot do. And so they want to be able to control everything that we do in order to commodify it. Same thing with jazz. They're in control of basically, melodic, rhythmic, and harmonic space. And so in ways that Western music cannot do it. So they try to cage it in something, like I said before, that can be easily defined, right? And so these groups, and I'm not afraid to name names at this state in history, we're talking about, the Eidos group and this FBA group that may be, are outside forces that have been disrupting the discourse of unity surrounding African peoples in the diaspora and in the continental United States. And they are attempting to, separate, so to speak, the Black experience in America from all other African diasporic experiences. I find this suspicious, and I find it as something that is basically doing the job of divide and rule, like I said, for the status quo. Bringing it back to the Olympics, there's a certain degree of entitlement that white hegemony has, white status quo has, in regards to creating a project and not going to the people who are masters of or have committed a lifetime to the particular art form that they are defining. That in and of itself, from my standpoint, is an act of ontological violence. You don't just come to my neighborhood with a book already and say, well, we formed a committee and here's the rule book we came up with. And then you come down to these people who are masters already, and you haven't asked them or talked to them about any of this stuff. And you're just basically imposing your will, your definitions on them in terms of what rules you've come up for, what is good and what is not, in a breakdancing, quote unquote contest. And so I find that to be an act of violence to begin with. And me just sitting here out on the West Coast, knowing, some things about, hip hop, but not from the standpoint of, growing up like the two of you did, on the East Coast. My question to that Olympic committee is, hip hop just celebrated its half century mark. Who are the people that organized that? Did you talk to those people? Who are the elders that were that are teaching currently, like our guest here today? Did you talk to this person? Did you get perspectives from them? If you haven't done that, your project to begin with is a passive aggressive act of violence from my standpoint. And this is what has happened with all of the art forms that I named before. I keep mine to today to three. There are more that I could talk about, but the three. With jazz, you had a whole several generations of white historians that were writing about jazz and writing about it as an object that they knew something about, but not from directly from the lived Black experience of the practicing masters. And the same thing with capoeira. There are people who have written books and claim to have a PhD in X, Y, and Z, but are not really practitioners who have gone in and talk to these people and understood right. what these organic intellectuals know about this art form. I'm gonna land my plane here. I'll make sure that I do this, because it's really heavy on my heart right now.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is that these people deserve to have the equity from the lifetime of genius that they put into it. And it disrespects the high level of organic intellectual mastery that they have for them to take a hop, skip, and a jump over them and then begin these narratives and definitions and rules and regulations for something and then put it on the world stage as if they know something about it. And that brings me full circle to this one white woman who her claim to being present, to being visible as she is that she, quote unquote, has a PhD. And, you know, and I know it from, you know, from that standpoint, that from my standpoint, unless she's been authenticated by the aforementioned masters that I said, and, you know, our guest here today could probably tell us who the better ones would be, like a Crazy Legs or someone, you know, someone of that nature, unless he or she, someone of Crazy Legs's, you know, stature authenticated her, then she's not authenticated. The institution right. that she went to and gave her doctorate does not authenticate her within this art form. You see where the power struggle comes right. from.
It is Hard Knock Radio. David D hanging out with you this afternoon. We're going to pause this interview. We appreciate everybody who's been listening. Hopefully you find this exciting or insightful. And we will pick up things on the next edition of Hard Knock Radio. Peace out for now, everybody.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, you just imitate. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio. Kind of crazy, though. Oakland, stand up.
Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue.
Let us. Ha. Hey, hey, hey. Ho, 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 Hard Knock Radio. East, west, hard north, south. Radio, conectados. Man. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Top, Ground Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415's bumping Hard Knock Radio, Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. Yo, and to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, rapping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, rapping to the hard side.
This is KBOO Portland.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Our first episode is Tuesday, September 3rd at 10 a.m. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.
This is Bird Note. Long-distance migration requires metabolic feats that dazzle the mind and lots of fat. Tiny blackpoll warblers double their weight in the lead-up to migration. Wilson's phalaropes may put on so much fat that they actually have to lose weight to get their fat-loaded bodies into the air. Chubby bar-tailed godwits, normally very strong flyers, may need a long-running start to take off. To store fat, birds may eat 3 times as much and forage over many more hours than normal as they prepare for long-distance travel. To process so much chow, a bird's stomach and intestines must physically grow in size. A bird's liver, the organ that turns nutrients into fats, might triple in size. At the cellular level, equally impressive changes make it possible for a bird to draw energy from all that fat during long flights. These include changes in fatty acids, plus a big bump in the protein molecules that move fats through the bloodstream. And there's a surge in enzymes that hand off the fat to the muscles, thus fueling the strenuous work of flight. If long migratory flights are amazing, what goes on inside a bird's body during those flights seems absolutely astonishing. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This is Bird Note. There's more than one way to catch an insect. Swallows swoop and glide in pursuit of prey, executing sharp turns and quick changes of speed. A bluebird perches on a utility wire and watches below. When the time is right, the bluebird pounces and clamps its bill on a choice bug. A willow flycatcher, ensconced in a large shrub, makes short, darting flights to snap up insects without leaving the shelter of the greenery. At twilight, a chuckwill's widow cruises just a few feet off the ground, its scoop-like mouth wide open, engulfing moths with the help of bristles around its gaping beak. The next morning, a hummingbird and a merlin are perched atop a bare tree. The merlin sallies out to snare a dragonfly in its talons, returning to its perch to pluck the wings off before devouring its catch.